Have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And now we'll do it once in Tibetan. Sam Chen Tam Che De Wa Dang De Wei Hu Dang Tan Pa Bu Chi bottom of the sheet will say Green Tower's mantra 7 times and Chenrega's mantra 8. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re So Ha. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum.
Thank you. And now you can go to your classes, and if you're here, if your child is here for the very first time, please accompany them so you know where they are and they know where you are. Thank you. Bye.
Had quite a crew this morning, huh? Good morning, everyone. Good to see you. The last two Sundays have been sitting in for your regular teacher, Geshe Gelick, who's, as you know, I'm taking a little sabbatical, well-earned sabbatical. And I've been talking about the, although you may not have noticed, we were talking about this one of the prayers that we did this morning, the four immeasurables. You know the four immeasurables? Do you know the four immeasurables, the prayer? Have you come before?
Yeah. No?
Okay, so I thought maybe you're, it's good that the new person's here. So you know what the four immeasurables are. Immeasurable. No, immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion.
I don't know them by the name.
And, immeasurable joy, and someone thought make great love, and immeasurable
equanimity.
Okay, so two previous classes I was talking about love and compassion, the difference between those and how you can meditate on that. And I wanted to ask, I asked in the earlier class, and no one knew, surprised, why are these thoughts, like, for instance, wouldn't it be wonderful if all living beings were endowed with happiness and the causes of happiness? That's called immeasurable love. Why is it called immeasurable? Why are they called the immeasurables? Where's Robbie Watkins? Is he there? Is he here? He's hiding somewhere? Immeasurable means limitless. That's a cop out. Yes. Yes. Oh, you were here last class, so you can't.
Well, that doesn't count. That doesn't count.
Anyone? Some of the older students? Yeah. That's interesting. You're meant to grow throughout, so immeasurable life, or what? Why? Oh, okay. That's an interesting take. He said you never stop growing in those areas in life or something like that in your spiritual life. Maybe there's something like that. Have you heard that, or that's just your logic? Your logic, okay. Generally, one of the explanations why they're called limitless or immeasurable, oh, there's Robbie, is that the sphere of your who you're thinking of is all living beings, immeasurable living beings. So sentient beings are not limited to the people on this earth. From a Buddhist perspective, there are other world systems even that there are living beings, maybe human beings, maybe they don't look like us, maybe even from Buddhist perspective wouldn't be unusual that, like in the science fiction movies, you know, the people might be green or have different arms but kind of humanoid like. That's not beyond the realm of possibility from a Buddhist perspective, but there are human beings in other realms, other universes even. Even within this universe, there are other planetary systems from a Buddhist perspective where there are humans, where the Dharma is being practiced, and other universes beyond this, innumerable, infinite numbers. And so, in one sense, immeasurable love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, in one sense, refers to the limitless nature of the object, the field that you're thinking about. May all of these limitless beings have that. Not limited to your friends, or may my friends have happiness, be free of suffering, and so forth, but everyone else, no, not like that. Immeasurable sentient beings. Also, in terms of, let's say, as an example, let's say, limitless compassion. May all living beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. It's not limited to certain kind of suffering, you know, like suffering of suffering. Maybe some of you don't know the differentiation. There, from a Buddhist perspective, there are three more and more subtle levels of unsatisfactoriness or suffering. There's the obvious suffering that we all experience called, that Buddhism calls suffering of suffering, or the unsatisfactory nature of suffering, you know. When we have a toothache, or we get stung by a bee, or we hear some, you know, someone criticizes us, or we're unhappy, whether it be mental or physical, that's called suffering of suffering. Animals understand suffering of suffering. You know, if you beat your kitty cat or your dog, you slap them, they get unhappy. Or if they get hurt, you can tell that they're suffering. Subtler level of suffering is what's sometimes called changeable suffering. And what it refers to is even the happiness that we have now that is from the very moment we're experiencing it is not really what it's hoped to be. It's just reducing one discomfort and replacing it with another discomfort. What we call relief or happiness is what Buddhists call changeable suffering. You might like to, I explained about this once 25 years ago, maybe in the capital of, what's it called? Where Amsterdam is, what's that country called? Netherlands. Den Haag, I think. Den Haag is the capital, right? Yeah, so I was giving some seminar. There was a seminar at the university on development. There were different weeks. One week was economic development, and they asked me to come and talk about mental development. There was a big group of people, Dutch scholars in their suits, men and women and everything. And when I talked about the fact that what we call happiness in the world is actually not real happiness, it's just a kind of relief that we label happiness. You're exchanging one suffering for another. And there's never any real, stable, continuous kind of happiness. It eventually is recognized as suffering. You know, when you're hot and you come into the cool room, at first you feel some pleasure, right? Some relief. You could also say relief, but we'd say, this is pleasant. This is nice. The suffering of heat is going down. The suffering of coolness is going up. While there's still in this situation, the bigger one is going down, we experience that as relief, and we call that pleasure. Ah, but as soon as the suffering of coolness exceeds the suffering of the heat, we start to go, let's go sit in the nice warm sun again, and then the situation reverses. If you think about anything in our life, from a Buddhist perspective, all the things that we cherish as real pleasure. Let's say if you're a meat and potatoes kind of guy or gal, you know, like meat and potatoes, or beer and nachos and football and sex and, you know, all of money and all of these kind of things, or more subtle kinds of pleasures like Mozart, Beethoven, or great art, or chess, or reading great works and of literature or whatever. All of these things we might think of as real. That's real pleasure. I remember at a seminar in Italy once when I mentioned this, and afterwards one of the patrons, a very wealthy lady whose husband owned some of the biggest art galleries in Zurich and I can't remember the other town there. She said, well, but George, excuse me, you know, this is real happiness, great art, you know, and Mozart, this is real happiness, you know, maybe these other things like meat and potatoes or, you know, whatever, that's not real happiness, but this is more sublime or something. From a Buddhist perspective, any kind of pleasure that we experience within cyclic existence, this kind of taking of rebirth again and again, is not all that our mind holds it to be. It's no more than, you know, relieving one discomfort. It might be a thirst or a longing by coming in contact with something else. This continued contact with, eventually we would recognize as overt suffering. If I were to tie Robbie Watkins down to a chair and have constantly read to him French cookbooks. At first, he would be in nirvana, you know, he would be blissed out, you know. He loves cookbooks and French cookbooks, you know. But after a couple of hours, maybe a week, in Robbie's case, maybe a month, he would say, "Stop! I don't want to hear anymore. I just want to relax. I don't want to hear any more French recipes. It's not innately pleasurable." So from the very moment he was listening to this, or from the very moment you sit in the cool after being hot, it's not real happiness. This kind of insight is something that human beings can understand. And in many spiritual traditions, this is the sense of renunciation, how we can give up our longing to be famous or powerful and rich and lead a spiritual life, put our energies not simply to try to find these sources of temporary happiness, changeable happiness, but to find what we might call Dharma happiness. Buddhism says there is happiness to be found. Nirvana is bliss or enlightenment. You know, the stages of the Bodhisattva path, incredibly blissful, but it's not contaminated happiness like we're experiencing. So to wish that sentient beings were free from suffering means not only free from suffering of suffering. Yeah, please. You could even sit in the front row if you want. Yeah. But may they be free from even changeable suffering. You might say, that sounds cruel. You know, we should have sunsets and pizzas and French cookbooks and all of these things. To be free of changeable suffering implies that people would find the deeper kind of happiness, you know, that they would, in being free of creating the causes to be born within cyclic existence in what are ultimately not the, you know, the final satisfying kind of Dharma happiness, to be free of that opens up the possibility to achieve that Dharma happiness. So they're called immeasurable because they include all kinds of, let's say, immeasurable compassion. Not only includes all sentient beings, immeasurable sentient beings, but may they be free of all immeasurable kind of suffering. Everything that is discordant and not ultimately satisfying and useful and eternal. Okay? So today I wanted to just talk a little bit about the third immeasurable, immeasurable joy. So could you read, how is it stated in your translation there? May all sentient beings, or not how wonderful it would be. Can you read? May all sentient beings be inseparable from a happiness that is free of suffering. So sometimes, sometimes it's translated how wonderful it would be, or may they be, or whatever. So what is this talking about? Immeasurable joy. Did someone else think that it had a different name? In one of the other discourse this morning, someone thought it was called. Sorrowless bliss. Okay. Immeasurable sorrowless bliss, or may they have sorrowless. They may never be separated from the sorrowless bliss. Okay, same thing. Bliss or happiness without sorrow, without suffering. Okay, I think Mao's the same thing. But that is called joy. In one sense, when other people experience, when we talk about compassion and you see people that are suffering, and if you develop compassion, it's a sense of engaging them and wanting them, feeling that unsatisfactory nature of that suffering and wanting them to be free of that, right? Immeasurable joy is recognizing the happiness that others have, But not just the contaminated happiness, but the sorrowless happiness, as you put it, or the happiness without sorrow, meaning maybe uncontaminated Dharma happiness. May living beings never be separated from that kind of happiness. So it's a counterpart in a sense, like love and compassion are somehow related. Joy and compassion, in the case of compassion, you're engaging in their suffering and wanting them to be free of that. In joy is you're engaging in the happiness that they do have in some cases and wishing them never to be separated from that. Of course, wishing them never to be separated from uncontaminated happiness or sorrowless bliss, but even ordinary, you know, happiness, we can extend it to that, even though the word says without, you know, the sorrowless bliss. What is that state of mind? Generally, when we experience the happiness of other people, there is the possibility of the mind of jealousy to arise. Do you know what jealousy is? A couple of you are nodding. I think the rest of you are very saintly beings. You know, what's he talking about? Jealousy. That's something that lower beings experience. Envy, jealousy, even sometimes resentment in when others have happiness, and for some reason in our own mind, we feel uncomfortable about that. There can be many causes. One, we might feel that we deserve that happiness. Right? Someone is like, has it ever happened to you that you've done some project or done something in the office or school or in the family and someone else got credit for it? And you want to say, excuse me, I did that. Has that ever happened? You know, so that feeling, what would you call that? Would that be envy or jealousy or
Indignation.
Yeah, indignation. That falls under this category also. Or if your companion, your loved one, your son or daughter, or your husband or wife, or your life companion, your boyfriend or girlfriend, or just whatever, is you see them on the street from the distance, and they're smiling and having fun with someone else. This is one of the classic ones, right? Or someone you're dating, or your wife or husband. What do you feel, what can arise in this situation? That's the word that we know generally, right? Jealousy. And there's a discomfort that arises in the mind in the happiness of these two people. Who is the person you feel jealous for? Here's your companion. Here's the other person they're enjoying the company of, dating or who knows what. Who do you feel jealous toward? Are you feeling jealous toward your companion or jealous toward the other person? The other person? Yeah, but you feel some discomfort about your companion, right? Also, they're having happiness, but you feel overtly jealous about the other person. They shouldn't be having the happiness of your companion smiling and embracing and whatever. You should be experiencing that, right? Does that make sense? You know, envy, what is envy? When someone else has, maybe receives, it's not an interpersonal relationship between two people, perhaps, but someone else receives a claim, or they're born wealthy or powerful, or they achieve some kind of thing, and you envy them. You might feel some resentment that they shouldn't have that, or it can be accompanied with just the wish that I wish I had that. You know, sometimes thinking that they shouldn't have that, I should have it instead, or some just I wish I had that. These states of mind, from a Buddhist perspective, leave you very uncomfortable. Is there anyone who feels comfortable about jealousy? sometimes we might, in our culture, we might think if our companion is jealous, that that's a good thing. It shows that they're, that they love us or something like that, right? Does that resonate with you? We sometimes think, you know, oh, that's good. I'm going to try to make them jealous so they'll appreciate me more or something like that. I'm going to flirt with this other person or something like that. At any rate, jealousy from a Buddhist perspective is not considered a peaceful state of mind. It's something that causes the mind to become, you know, disturbed. You're unhappy in some ways. It's not something that you want to experience. And it creates, long-term, it creates negative actions. It is an action which is creating negative imprints in our mind called karmic imprints to experience suffering in the future. Jealousy, envy, indignation. So joy, rejoicing in the happiness of others, is a state of mind where you, instead of feeling jealous about someone else, thinking, may they have that happiness and continue to have that happiness. How can you develop that state of mind in certain circumstances? You might think it's unjust that they have that happiness. There are different kinds of reasonings that will occur in your mind. One of this, some of you know that what we call the seven-limbed prayer, seven-limbed puja. You know, what was the first one? What? Prostration, an offering, confession, or, you know, purifying negative karma. And the fourth one is called rejoicing in the good fortune and the merits of other sentient beings, not feeling jealousy or resentment about that, and wishing the Buddhas to remain, turn the wheel of Dharma, dedicating merits. There's seven actions that we do to try to purify negative karma and accumulate merit. One of them is joy, feeling rejoicefulness. When other people experience good fortune, or they're creating the karma to be happy in the future, like they're being generous, or they're making prostrations. You might also feel, from a spiritual point of view, you might feel jealous about that too. Oh, so-and-so has a chance to do a retreat. Feel jealous about that, envious or resentful or something like that. You should be doing that. So to think, the various ways to counter these minds of jealousy, envy, resentment, and so forth. Thinking, for instance, of the law of cause and effect, what we call in Buddhist perspective, when we talk about law of cause and effect, it's not like Newton's, was it third law?
Yes.
Which is what? That's usually how we say, right? Every action. So if you're on the ice rink and you're a kid, you don't know this yet, and you push Sister Susie away, you actually get pushed away too from the spot where you're, you know. Every action, that's the basis of all of our mechanics. If you throw a ball against the wall, when it touches the wall, there's an equal and opposite force on it, reaction pushing it back this way. So in the psychic realm, we talk about the law of karma and its effect. When we say action, we talk about actions in the physical world, you know, croquet balls and, you know, rockets and things like this. But generally, when we talk about the law of cause and effect, the actual words in the Buddhist scriptures are karma and its effects. Action, mental actions. Karma means, generally, and those of you who are coming to the Friday class, you know, there's some exceptions, but generally we mean mental actions. Like jealousy, or anger, or kindness, they all have a corresponding reaction. I mentioned in the other class also, when I've asked people, youngsters generally, what karma means, one of the things, like in high school classes or grade school classes that come to the monastery to see, they'll sometimes say, oh, yeah, I know what karma means. It means what goes around comes around. Have you heard that expression? Oh, yeah. That's kind of like a very common expression now. Is that a good explanation of karma? Where's that phrase come from? Does anyone know? You don't know. Okay, that's good. I searched on. I asked the omniscient Google as one of my Dharma friends, Yangtze Rinpoche, said once. Let's ask the omniscient Google, the Googleplex, whatever. And Google came up with the fact that this expression came about from the Dark Ages when the plague was going around. And if Venerable were to ask me, George, is the plague coming to the Gompa, coming to the village? What goes around comes around. This is more or less talking about inevitability. I'm not talking about so much really karma. I think a better expression of karma is what Christ is purported to have said in the Bible. Ye reap what ye sow. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. If we talk about Newtonian expression of that, rephrasing Christ in Newtonian terms. Every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Or in Buddhist terms, for every karmic deed, there is going to be eventually some kind of maturation, fruition, or result upon your experience in the future, appropriate to the cause that created it. If you create negative causes, you're going to have a harvest. You will reap a harvest of unfortunate experiences, unpleasant experiences. If you sow the seeds of good actions, selfless, kind, patient, loving, generous, and so forth, you will experience pleasant reactions in the future, a pleasant harvest, so to speak. You will reap that. So, looking at the happiness of others, to recognize that there's no way that this person, even if they are, I was trying to find the literary term, or not the literary term, the more correct term, even if they're a rascal, I mean, there's some word like this, they don't deserve this, they're the scion of some wealthy family, and they grow up proud and they're a multimillionaire and they disdain other people and they use their position to put other people down condescendingly. How could you not want them to have that, right? You wouldn't necessarily feel jealousy of that or envy. Maybe you feel indignation, right? Toward that kind of thing. They shouldn't have that happiness. They didn't deserve it. Well, even in situations like that, or when your companion is talking to another person, to recognize there's no way they could have this happy moment or this success or wealth or whatever unless they created the karma in the past. In so doing, there is a thought in your own mind, if I want to have happiness, continued happiness in the future, I should also create the causes of happiness. So the thought that retreats away from jealousy, envy, and indignation, and is accepting and even joyful in the other person's experience of happiness now, whether it be sorrowless or not, that kind of joy not only acts as an antidote to creating negative karma of jealousy, envy, and indignation, but actually creates virtuous karma. Have you heard that before? You know that, right? So it's incredibly, it's like a what's his name, Homer Simpson? It's like, duh. Of course, if I, you know, that's the most skillful thing to do. Rather than feeling jealous, creating negative karma, if I can meditate and rejoice in the other person's virtue, I not only don't create the negative karma, but I create virtuous karma. But how can you do that? How can you overcome the jealousy? Well, one way to begin to think is that this other person has experienced this not because of some chance right now, or only because of the conditions they've created now, cheating and maybe smiling and making people like them. There's no way they could experience whatever happiness they are now unless they created the karmic cause of it in a previous life. So that helps to extricate the mind from projecting upon the situation reasons for their happiness that are not the primary reason. And you can think, in so doing, if I want to be happy, I should create the same kind of causes. How wonderful it is that the law of cause and effect works. How wonderful it is that they're having happiness. May they continue to have happiness, but not just this contaminated happiness. May they never be separated from a happiness that is even beyond this, that is without any kind of suffering at all, uncontaminated happiness. There is a story in the Buddha's life when he was invited for a meal by a wealthy patron, someone a little bit full of himself. You know, there was sometimes competition, even at the time of the Buddha, people making vast feasts for the Buddha and his disciples. A little bit pride and boastful or whatever you call it, you know, status symbol. We gave the biggest feast. Is that, you know what I'm talking about, right? I mentioned in the other class, in Italy, I remember there was some town where there were these towers that they built in the Middle Ages for the church. Maybe the bell towers. Do you know what I'm talking about? Where is that? San Gimignano. Yeah. And we understand historically it was kind of like competition. One village, or even in the same village, one family would build a tower and the other place would build a bigger one. Well, it happens now with the tallest buildings in the world, right? Where's the tallest one now? Is it Malaysia still or Dubai? Dubai? But, you know, it was like, it's not like out of altruism they're building these. There's a little bit of pride involved. So this patron was offering a huge feast to the Buddha. And it was the tradition as a result of this that at the end, after partaking of the meal, the Buddha would then give a Dharma discourse. It's kind of symbolic of the symbiotic relationship between the laity and the clergy, the Sangha. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you know what symbiotic means? So the symbiotic relationship also in the Catholic clergy and the laity. The laity would provide funds for the monastery or whatever, and the clergy would provide spiritual sustenance to the community. The Buddhist community is like that. Usually the laity provide housing, clothing, and food. You know, new robes for the monks and nuns and food. They would go on alms and they would provide some kind of housing protection from the elements. It wouldn't have to be luxurious, but, you know. And the monks and nuns would provide teachings, guidance, initiation, what do you call it, vows and teachings, advice, and so forth. So the Buddha would give teaching after this meal, and at the end, he would recognize the great merit created by the patron, and he would make some prayers. He wouldn't dedicate their merit. Usually, in order to dedicate your own karma, you have to do that yourself. It's a mental action. May this action that I've created become the cause of my future spiritual development and so forth. If someone else prays for that, it has some effect, but it's not the same as your own dedication. But the Buddha would do prayers for the people, the patrons. And in this particular circumstance, because the patron was a little bit proud, but there was also outside the gates of the grounds, there was a mendicant, poor person, say a beggar, who didn't have any wealth, and they were viewing this situation. They weren't allowed in. You know what that's like, right? The discotheque or something. I hear you have to, sometimes you can't get in, you know, all the beautiful people are inside. He's out there, and he's, instead of being jealousy about this, he's rejoicing how wonderful it is that this person has been able to create this virtuous karma offering to the Buddha. If I had the wealth, I would, you know, make beautiful offerings, and, you know, thinking of the benefits of this, the spiritual benefits. In so doing, in not feeling jealousy or resentment or whatever, that person actually created more virtuous karma than the patron. Have you heard a similar story to this? Maybe some of you have. So when it came time for the Buddha to dedicate or to pray for the patron's good fortune, instead he was pointing out the beggar outside the fence and said, this person has, I'm not going to bother with your merits, I'm going to dedicate and pray for this person's merits to be multiplied and so forth, because he's created much more in rejoicing. So this state of immeasurable joy, or immeasurable, can be also rejoicing, if something is already there. This creates, let's say, if we rejoice in the good merits, the good fortune, or the karma that someone has created, those are two steps, right? First you create karma, then you experience the fortune of that. But one will lead to the other. So you can rejoice in the good karma of others and in the fruition of that, their good fortune. When you do so, if they're on a similar spiritual level to you, you create the same karma that they've created. Say that someone has done good to Bodh Gaya and done 100,000 prostrations. That might not mean anything to some of you. Some of you might think, wow, that'd be great. Rather than feeling envy or jealousy, if you were to, wow, that is wonderful that so-and-so has done this, you create, if they're of the same spiritual level as you, you create the same merit that they created effortlessly. You don't have to do 100,000 prostrations. Lamazopa Rinpoche used to joke, he said, rejoicing is the lazy man's way of creating merit. He said, I can sit on my cushion in my room, and the monks at the monastery at Koban will come and put water bowls on the altar. And even though I'm not making the offerings, if I rejoice in that, I create, you know, great virtuous karma. If you are at a higher spiritual level than the individual who's creating some action, and you rejoice in that, you create even more virtuous karma in rejoicing than they're creating. If you were at a lower spiritual level, like say for instance, if we ourselves rejoice in the great virtuous activities of the Dalai Lama, I'm not saying you're not the same level of the Dalai Lama, I'm not the same level of the Dalai Lama. If I rejoice in that, I don't create as much merit, but I create some fraction of the merit he's creating, or the Buddha's actions, or the Bodhisattvas, or great saints, and so forth. Do you understand? So lower depends on what level, spiritual level you are in rejoicing. So immeasurable joy creates incredible amount of virtuous karma. It helps to eliminate envy, jealousy, resentment. Brings the mind to a very peaceful state. Makes you not a threat to others. If someone, do you know anyone who's jealous? Do you know people in your lives? Are they viewed as pleasant to have around? Generally not. We might, in some way that our mind thinks, we might think that jealousy is good, or those jealous people are good to have around or something. But generally, they're not pleasant to be around because they're not enjoying. And also, a jealous person is sometimes seen to be a threat to others because they want to change. They're going to try to attain something that others have. So if we can overcome jealousy, we can be and rejoice in others' good fortune rather than standing up, oh, you shouldn't be getting all that, you know, all that acclaim. You shouldn't have that. I should have it. Everyone looks at you and thinks, you know, wow, where did that come from? You know, and it's not pleasant. We might seem to be a threat so that others might try to to thwart us and prevent us from our success and so forth. So overcoming jealousy, resentment, and envy makes us more lovable, less threatening to others. We become more of a friend to others. You understand? So how can we, what are other ways? What are the strategies? So those are some of the advantages. What are the strategies in meditation? When you try to do mind training, train the mind to overcome faults and develop good qualities, first step is to recognize the disadvantages of the negative states. Let's say disadvantage of jealousy, envy, resentment, and so forth. Get that very clear in the mind so you have some reason to seek an antidote or to apply an antidote. It's like the Four Noble Truths. First, the Buddha talked about the truth of suffering to motivate. Then he talked about the cause of suffering. And then what can happen? There's a cessation of suffering and there's a path that leads to that. So first think about the disadvantages of jealousy and so forth. And then what the state that we could achieve is, you know, a state free of that is feeling joy in the happiness of others. Not just their contaminated happiness, but the sorrowless happiness. Not begrudging them worldly happiness, even being happy, even being content with the worldly happiness of others, but wishing them to have a happiness that is without sorrow, without suffering, uncontaminated happiness. So then how to do that? Then you have to apply the antidotes. Think about karma. This is the happiness of others comes about because of karma. So if they do have happiness, it is just. It is not unjust. There's no way that they could experience that without creating a karma. And in so doing, you're thinking, may I create that similar kind of karma? You know, accepting that. Like the beggar outside the fence. If I had, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could do that? You create immense amount of merit. Recognizing that you yourself will be less of a threat to others, that your own mind will be more peaceful without jealousy in these other states of mind, then consciously wishing them, wouldn't it be wonderful if all living beings, my enemies, had a state of joy that is without suffering. They were never separated from the joy that they've already achieved, which is, and indeed, go higher and higher till they find a joy that is without suffering, sorrowless joy. Once you've analyzed in various ways like this, embellishing your meditation with other factors, such as the fact that all of these living beings are like you. You know what it's like when you experience a state that's without sorrow. Some moment maybe you have things going right. How wonderful that is. Other beings are exactly the same. They want to experience that same kind of state. Sensing and meditating on the equality of oneself and others. How we're exactly the same and wanting to be free of suffering, wanting to have happiness, using that as a reason also in analytical meditation, thinking in these various ways, imagining in front of you, first of all, your enemies, those people who push your jealousy or envy or indignation buttons, and think how wonderful it would be if they were never separated from happiness that is free from sorrow. And then extend that to all other living beings that are around you in space, whether they be now humans or animals or in other realms, how that doesn't threaten your own happiness. Actually, again, thinking, one kind of devil's advocate in your mind might say, but if other people have a claim and have, you know, and this renown and power and so forth, that will diminish my happiness. I won't be held in as much esteem. Could you imagine that coming up in the mind? So to think, actually, when a person is rejoicing in others, even acclaiming them and celebrating that, they're not seen as a threat. We ourselves would be loved by others rather than shunned because of our jealousy and resentment and always carping about other people's good fortune or something like that. So counteracting these various discordant thoughts that will come up that would prevent you from having a feeling joy in the happiness of others. Imagine besides enemies in front, those who you're jealous of, all other sentient beings around, but particularly your friends and family behind you, who it is easy to feel joy in their happiness, wishing them not only to have all the joy this lifetime, but uncontaminated joy, sorrowless joy. Don't put them in the forefront, because they're very easy to feel that sentiment for. But imagine this feeling of joy, rejoicing in the good fortune of others and wishing them never to be separated from this joy, pervading all living beings. Using these various analytical methods of meditation, when you've come to some resolution of that where you have a little taste, I don't know, what does that mean when you go like this? It can mean money, I guess. I'm doing it for, it's like you're counting money. But this is, I think of it as like something tangible, some taste of the meditation, some experience of that. Yeah, I could see that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if beings were never separated from the joy they have now and were inseparable from sorrowless joy? Rejoicing and going further than rejoicing about the joy they have, may they be never be separated from, the path that leads to nirvana and enlightenment and so forth. Mind very content, very happy, very joyous. Hold that state single-pointedly then. Generally, when we do meditation, what brings about success is an alternation. First thinking about something, analyzing it in many different ways so that you see it clearly, some truth that is going to be wholesome for your own development, or in some cases it's not some truth that you're looking at, like impermanence or something, but actually trying to develop a state of mind like love or compassion or joy, and analyzing it in various ways till you actually experience that state. Once that state is experienced, then holding it single-pointedly. Give up analyzing at that point and just savor the taste of that. Does that make sense verbally? Savor, hold that without wavering. Leave an imprint in your mind of that so that it becomes part and parcel of your personality, deeply embedded in your consciousness, so that it's easily arisen again in the future. And then when you say these words, may all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless joy, or however it's phrased, some immediate, you can call to mind that feeling, and merely saying those words brings again that experience. Otherwise, just saying the words millions of times doesn't have an awful lot of benefit. I mean, leave some imprint to say them again in the future. Maybe someday you'll actually meditate on them and put them into action. Okay? So let's try this. Let's do a scientific experiment. Not Newtonian, but Buddhist. Sit comfortably. We're going to meditate on limitless or immeasurable joy. So, immeasurable in the sense that it's covering all sentient beings, limitless sentient beings, immeasurable sentient beings, and all of the joy that they have now, not begrudging them anything, but But even if they have a glimmer of uncontaminated joy, sorrowless joy, may they never be separated from that. May they continue on the paths that lead higher and higher. My teacher, Lama Yeshe, used to say, if there was ever jealousy, you know, someone else was getting high, you know, more studies, studying more than you, or had a chance to do more meditation, you might feel jealous or something. Lama Yeshe would say, we're all going to the same destination, dear. You know, no problem. We're going to the same place they are. So there's no need to feel jealousy about that. So first, begin by watching 7 respirations. Slowly, very consciously concentrating on the inhalation and exhalation to clear your mind of any other distracting thoughts. Then put your attention, first of all, imagining in front of you individuals that you might presently feel some jealousy or envy, resentment, whatever, indignation over their happiness. Around them in space, around you, all directions, all living beings, whether they be in the animal realm, human realm, hell realm, ghosts, gods, whatever. And particularly behind you, your friends and loved ones, that it's easy to feel joy toward. And analyze someone in front that pushes your jealousy button or whatever. Their happiness that they're experiencing is a result of their past virtuous karma. It's only just, it's right, even though what they have done this lifetime may not justify that, or it may. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could create that karma? So feel easy with their experiencing of that joy. Maybe even create virtuous karma by thinking it would be wonderful and right, and I will try to create the virtuous karma to experience this kind of joy and so forth. Law of cause and effect is infallible. Thinking that if I can overcome my jealousy, my resentment, or my unease in their happiness, I can both overcome creating negative karma, but actually create virtuous karma. It's right that they be happy because, like me, I want to be happy. I want to be free of suffering. How wonderful it would be if I were to have a sorrowless happiness, never be separated from it, never oscillate down, never go up and down in our daily life, but find the spiritual path that leads to unhindered happiness in the future, Dharma happiness, sorrowless happiness. In the same way, these living beings, although I might recognize them as somehow distant from me now, they've been my mother in the past, my best friend. They will become my friend and companions in the future. Maybe they'll be my teacher, and their good success and happiness and good qualities now will be something that will benefit me in the future. Without jealousy, I'll be less of a threat to others. I'll be looked upon by others as a friend, someone who's endearing. Rather than stepping low and doing the ignoble thing of jealousy and so forth, I'm going to be noble and feel the openness in my heart, you know, letting go of the knot of jealousy and resentment and grudge and so forth toward others, wishing that they find this kind of Dharma happiness. If you can see that with one person, with an enemy, or someone who that you presently feel jealous toward, extend it to others. Their success doesn't imperil your own happiness and success. Their Dharma happiness, you know, their inseparability from sorrowless joy can become an inspiration to you, become a benefit to you by their becoming a teacher and so forth, a companion. And as they develop that state, they will look upon you with compassion and love, not as a competitor, especially if your mind is not holding jealousy and attachment, jealousy, envy, and resentment and so forth. We're all going to the same destination. Spread that to all living beings around you. And of course to your friends and family and loved ones behind you. When you get a little taste, when you savor that immeasurable joy, not just toward one person, but immeasurable beings, feeling content with the sorrowless happiness of all living beings, try to hold that single-pointedly. We're all going to the same destination. protect that up with the words, that feeling. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering or sorrowless joy. So when you say those words in the future, this remembering consciousness of this state can arise. Yeah, that's right. It's just. It's wonderful. And finally, dedicate the virtuous karma that we've created this morning. Dedication is wishing that this karma ripen in a particular way. Due to these merits I've created, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual practice, benefiting others day by day, year by year, life by life. As a result of this karma, may, in my spiritual practice, may I quickly become of ultimate benefit to sentient beings by becoming myself perfected, enlightened. Due to these merits, may I quickly become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. And then relax. We're just about finished in time. Any comment or observation anyone wants to make? How was your meditation? Yeah.
I think my biggest obstacle is when I see someone who is experiencing happiness, they are powerful in the sense of the world, and they are happy, but what their actions are causing suffering to a lot of sentient beings.
Right, the tyrants and, yeah. The...
So I can be happy for them, but then immediately springs to mind what their actions, misguided as they are causing.
Right, so we wish them to have never be separated from sorrowless happiness. So uncontaminated happiness would be one in which could be an extension of, you know, wishing that in a sense that their present ripening of virtuous karma be one in which their mind was free of these delusions that are causing them to be arrogant and using that power or status or whatever to demean others or the environment or whatever they might be doing. But to feel, not to feel that it's illogical or that, you know, that they're feeling happiness, to understand the law of cause and effect. Sometimes people are in the Christian, the Judeo-Christian, or the peoples of the book, they feel, you know, God, I'm giving up on God, you know, because he's, you know, he's given suffering to those who are meek and, you know, the child in the womb or a little baby who's never done anything bad and gives these good things to, you know, the tyrants and so forth. That's a dilemma in, at least in Christianity, to try to figure out why. Or I think there's books about that too, like the Jewish people talk about the cookbooks or something like that, you know, why do bad things happen to good people or vice versa, or chicken soup for the mind or something like that. From Buddhist perspective, we look at it a different way. The suffering and happiness doesn't come about because of bestowal from a divine being, but because of our previous actions. So we have a way of resolving that part, not being feeling unjust, the injustice of suffering or happiness, but wishing that the individuals be able to change over time. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll be here next Sunday. There will be a puja, a ceremony this afternoon, a Medicine Buddha healing ceremony. dedicated for all sentient beings, but particularly for the mother of Shankha, one of our members, and another Dharma practitioner out in Washington, Oregon State. You're welcome to attend for your own, you know, healing and so forth. And we'll see you. Thank you very much.